Oh, welcome to Left Out. Left Out is a public affairs program produced by WRCT 88.3 FM at Carnegie Mellon University that discusses the news from a perspective left out of the mainstream media. I'm Bob Harper.
I'm Danny Slater.
And today's program is produced by Molly Meyer. Listeners are welcome to call us at 412-268-9728 or to send electronic mail during the program to bob@leftout.info.
We have a couple of announcements. Well, actually, mainly just one announcement this week. Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, which you can listen at 8 a.m. each weekday right here on WRCT. She was in Pittsburgh on Thursday, and she gave two addresses to packed halls and standing ovations. In case you missed these events, you can still see Amy Goodman in a film called Independent Media in a Time of War. It's going to be shown on Wednesday, December 1st in Cafe Bliss in Point Breeze, which is 7332 Penn Avenue. And so that's on Wednesday, December 1st at 7 p.m. at Cafe Bliss in Point Breeze. So if you missed Amy Goodman when she was here, you should check out Independent Media in a Time of War. So
okay, so our first topic for today, we would like to welcome to our program Ray McGovern, who will be talking with us today about intelligence matters and Middle East policy. Many of you will have heard, many of our listeners will have heard of or seen Ray McGovern or read his writings. He's recently come to some prominence in the particularly the alternative media through his organization called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which he formed in January 2003. In partly in response to the reaction to the Iraq war. Many of you will have seen Ray McGovern appear in the movie Iraq Uncovered: The War on Iraq, and also in Hijacking Catastrophe, I think, which we recently showed at Carnegie Mellon. And he has a chapter in a new book out. The book is called Patriotism, Democracy, and Common Sense, which is a collection of writings on those topics, including a chapter by Ray McGovern called A Compromised Central Intelligence Agency, What Can Be Done? So there are a number of topics that we would like to talk with Mr. McGovern about today, but including the whole handling of the intelligence that prior to the 9/11 attacks, the handling of the intelligence prior to the Iraq war. We would like to talk a bit about the Valerie Plame affair, which seems to have been dropped out of the picture recently, out of the news. And the 9/11 Commission report, the Senate Intelligence Committee report, and the recent and ongoing reforms at the Central Intelligence Agency. So, Ray McGovern, welcome to Left Out.
Glad to be with you, Bob and Denny.
I wondered if you could please start out, if you would, and feel free to take your time. We have plenty of time here today. I wondered if you would please start out by telling us a bit about your background and experience so that our listeners know something of your expertise and from which you're speaking.
Sure. I'm one of those who came down here to Washington after John F. Kennedy appealed to us to think about what we might do for our country rather than what our country might do for us. Those were heady days, and I started my career in the U.S. Army as a first lieutenant, did my 2 years there, and since I had majored in Russian undergraduate and taken a graduate degree in that as well, it was a natural to think about working for a newly established agency called the Central Intelligence Agency, the more so since I was really intrigued by the way it was sold to me, namely that I would be responsible for gathering all the information available on a specific country or issue that would all be made available to me, and all I'd have to do is try to make some sense out of it, and if we're important enough, the chances would be good that the president would be reading about it the next morning. That seemed too good to be true, but in reality, I'm happy to say it wasn't too good to be true. It was good, and it was true, and worked real well for most of my career until toward the end the agency started to be corrupted by people who had political agendas, and now we've seen that run its full course.
And so your responsibilities at the CIA, could you maybe summarize some of the highlights of your career there?
Sure. I started out as an analyst of Soviet foreign policy, mm-hmm. Then I worked on Soviet internal affairs, then I had wider responsibilities for Europe and Asia, and toward the end I chaired the genre of reporting called national intelligence estimates, which is the premier genre, the most official communication between the head of the CIA and the president. And then I also worked on writing, producing, and actually briefing downtown something called the President's Daily Brief, which is a publication we produced six times a week. And I worked in the team, and I used to go down every other day, every other morning, and see the Vice President, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. Not all of them in each day, but either two or three of them worked together with another person, and we would, depending on their schedule, see two or three of them each and come back and report to our people at the agency what the interest was, what unanswered questions there were, and how we might fill in those answers the next day.
So fair to say that you really played a central role in the intelligence that was delivered to the president or to the White House National Security Staff for a number of years.
It was my privilege to have that briefing responsibility one-on-one with these gentlemen that I just mentioned. But of course, the whole thing is a team effort, and we worked in teams during the day, and even when we went off briefing, as I said, there would be five people to cover. It would be a team of two, and we'd come in early in the morning, update ourselves on what happened overnight, and compare notes, and then go off to our respective briefees.
Okay. So one topic that I know will come up shortly, but maybe since you brought it up, it'd be a good opportunity to raise it, which is to explain just what is a national intelligence estimate. Most of us, like me, who weren't privy to such things until the Iraq War, when we started hearing about it in the run-up to the Iraq War, and I wondered if you might explain to us and our listeners what that is and what's involved in writing one of those and presenting one and so forth.
Yeah, this is important business because many, as you say, many of the national intelligence estimates recently have been in the news. Suffice it to say that this is the sort of premier publication based on the agency's true mission, which is twofold, really. One, I already mentioned, it's the one place in government where all the information from whatever source, open sources, clandestine sources, photography, intercepted communications, embassies, spies, you name it, it all came into my inbox, and I was accountable. And there's a word that fell into disuse here in Washington. I was actually accountable for keeping track of what was going on, and if there was something significant, it was my responsibility to point that out and to write it up. So that's what we call it, the Central Intelligence Agency. There was one person responsible for doing that. Secondly, and equally important, it seemed very obvious that it would be necessary to have one place in government that could tell it like it is, that could speak without fear or favor, a place that didn't have a policy agenda like the State Department or like the Defense Department, which in those days always tried to make the Russians to be 10 feet tall, some place where the president could go and say, look at the director and say, look, I just want to know what you and you have two universities worth of experts out there. I want to know what you and your experts think about this particular country or this particular issue. And I don't care what the State Department or the Defense Department, I want you to tell me like it is. Now, if you can imagine what a tool that is in the hands of the president, who can go to such a person, trust him, and not have any suspicion that this fellow wouldn't be telling me what I want to hear, you know, but we really told to me straight. Well, that's what we had for most of the years, the 27 years that I spent there, and the culmination of that analysis would appear in something called the National Intelligence Estimate. This was a product of the whole intelligence community, which the head of the CIA also heads, about 14 or 15 intelligence agencies. They would get together on a topic. We did one every year on Soviet strategic study, strategic strength. We did one whenever there was a crisis, the prospects for Spain after Franco, and obviously there have been more recent ones on things like prospects for Eastern Europe paleontologist estimate dated October 1, 2002, the one that that told the president and everyone else that there were all kinds of very dangerous weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that Iraq was embarked on a nuclear program, and that it could do all manner of other things, like fly drones into the United States with biological or chemical weapons. That estimate is demonstrably faulty on all major counts, and that is really a shame, because it's the worst estimate on record, and its closest rival, really, is the one that was produced in September of 1962, which said that the Soviets would never try to put missiles in Cuba, even as those missiles were headed toward Cuba on Soviet ships. Now, the difference there is that that was an honest mistake.
Right. So this is what I wanted to bring up.
The estimate that was dated October 1, 2002, was a dishonest effort from start to finish.
Are these classified, or are there two versions, the classified and the unclassified version of the NIE?
Well, it's a very good question. On very important ones, often an unclassified version is prepared. In this case, the unclassified version dropped all manner of adverbs and adjectives, and you'd go, for example, from saying the Soviets probably have started a nuclear program to the Soviets have started a nuclear program in the unclassified version. Now, don't ask me what's classified about probably. Well, what's classified about, as far as we know, or it is unclear that, but they were all dropped off. Now,
you mean
why
were they for the Iraq off? One? You mean which one was were they dropped
in? The Iraq one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. The unclassified version was used widely on the Hill. You see, the sole purpose, this is what's really interesting and what most people don't know. The sole purpose of that estimate was to deceive our elected representatives into ceding their prerogative to declare war, to authorize war, to the executive, to the president. Now, that's pretty serious, because, as you probably remember from your civics or from your early history, American history, you know that the people who framed our Constitution came out of this English experience where kings would merrily march their people off to war, for their own good, of course, but there was no check on that, on those kings. There was hardly any way to resist that, and so the people who drafted our Constitution were hell-bent and determined that that would never happen in this country, and so into the very first article of our Constitution, they wrote very carefully that the authority to wage war or to approve war vests exclusively in the elected representatives of the American people in the Congress, not in the executive.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
And so that's why this is important, because what happened here is that this administration co-opted the CIA to advance a rationale, including mushroom clouds and everything else, for a war that the administration had decided to start several months prior to that estimate.
Yeah, so this is a very important point, and I wonder if you could please amplify that a little bit, which was that the National Intelligence Estimate came after, quite clearly, even to someone like me who has no inside information, came clearly after the decision to go to war with Iraq.
Yeah, it's very clear. You see, what happened was this. We know that the president and the people that he brought in with him, the so-called neoconservatives, and I have to say that it almost sticks in my mouth when I say neoconservatives, because these folk are not conservative in any real sense of that term. They are neo-radicals, and I am a conservative, and I resent deeply that they've hijacked that term, but nevertheless, they are called neocons, so let's call them that. When they came into office, they already had an agenda, and on top of that agenda was getting rid of Saddam Hussein. And so at the very first National Security Council meeting on the 30th of January 2001, the whole meeting was dominated by the president saying, how are we going to get Saddam? When are we going to get Saddam? Not if we should get Saddam or whether we should get Saddam, but when are we going to get him? And how do we know that? Well, we know that because a person who was there,
the Secretary of Treasury.
Secretary of Treasury has written that in his book.
Who was from Pittsburgh.
And when was that again? When was that?
That was January 30th, 2001.
That's but right after the inauguration, basically.
Yeah, that was the first National Security Council meeting. Now, then came 9/11, and you remember, I'm sure, Richard Clark discussing what happened on 9/12 when the president in the White House Situation Room dragged Clark and a few others, witnesses, into a room and said, was it Iraq? Was it Iraq? And Clark, stunned, said, "Sir, I told you yesterday that it was Osama bin Laden, it was Al-Qaeda, and they don't have anything to do with Iraq." You pursue that. You make sure that you pursue every lead about Iraq. You hear me? And Clark, he was just really baffled by that until he realized what was going on. Now, that was 9/12. Just the juice. We analysts, of course, love to do these little chronologies that help us analyze. But I'll just raise one more point, and that is 9/20. So it's that nine days after 9/11. Tony Blair was in town, just as he was last week, and he was having dinner with the president. And we know what happened there because the British ambassador at the time has now written his memoirs, and of course he was at the dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And the discussion went like this, the president saying, "Tony, you know, we're going to Afghanistan in just a week or two, but that's not going to take very long, and very quickly we're going to turn our troops into Iraq. Are you with me, Tony? Are you with me?" And Blair, of course, shocked, said, "Yeah, I guess, sure, sign me up." So here we have, you know, 9 days after 9/11, the president already had decided to enlist his closest ally in this adventure against Iraq. Now, what was the intelligence saying at that time?
That's a good question.
That's really interesting.
Before we jump to that, let me just remind our listeners. So we're speaking with Ray McGovern, who is a 27-year veteran of the CIA and founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And he's recently written a chapter, amongst many of his writings, he's recently written a chapter in a new book called Patriotism, Democracy, and Common Sense. And we're talking with Mr. McGovern today about intelligence matters and the last 4 years, particularly since the 9/11 prior to and immediately prior to and after the 9/11 attacks. And listeners are welcome to call us at 412-268-9728 if they wish. So, Mr. McGovern, so we were talking about the National Intelligence Estimate and that was written about a year after the 9/11 attacks. I wondered if you could go on.
Hello?
Yes.
I really should disclaim sole foundership of VIPS.
There
were five of us that co-founded that.
Okay, I should say co-founder then. Okay.
2003, yeah. And now we're up to about 45 from all the intelligence agencies you can imagine. So it's not just a CIA sort of thing either. But getting back to what the intelligence was saying, when all this, all these raised, all these decisions were being made about going to war, well, there are two sides of this. Before 9/11, Colin Powell got up in early 2001 and said, "Saddam Hussein has been unable to develop anything in the way of weapons of mass destruction. He is not even a threat to his immediate neighbors in a conventional sense."
Right,
he
I remember
that
this.
In February 2001. Condoleezza Rice, on the 29th of July 2001, said, "We've been able to keep his arms from him. He's not a threat to anyone, Saddam Hussein." Now, that's, 29 July? That's 6 weeks or so between that and 9/11. And right after 9/11, we all of a sudden heard the administration saying that Saddam Hussein had acquired weapons of mass destruction. And so, you know, when I'm talking around at colleges and universities, I ask them now, what's the automatic response when you say after 9/11 everything changed, right? Everything changed. Well, are we being asked to believe then that on 9/10 there were no weapons of mass destruction, but on 9/12 they rained down from the heavens and lighted softly on the sands of Iraq like manna from heaven? Give me a break. The intelligence was not saying anything in early 2002. Why? Well, the answer is cowardice and sycophancy. An honest intelligence estimate at that time would have said, in effect, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq beats the hell out of us. You know, we know we destroyed 90% of them in 1991, but the inspectors left in 98. We don't really know what happened after 98. We don't have any evidence one way or the other. That's what an honest estimate would have said. Now, you can imagine how delighted a president, already having decided upon war, would have been to get such a squishy estimate. And so no estimate was written, no estimate was requested, the decisions were made, and then only when they got back from vacation in the summer of 2002, when someone pointed out to the president and his advisors that there is this Constitution thing, and that his father, at least, took pains to get Congress to go along with the war in 1990, and so he ought to try too. Only then, did it become necessary to do an estimate. Why? Well, because some of the sleepy Congress watchdogs, supposed watchdogs over the intelligence community, woke up and said, well, what does the intelligence say about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? And the answer was an embarrassing, well, they haven't said anything about that. And so don't you think we should have an estimate? And at that point, George Tenet, the head of the CIA, could no longer resist that pressure. He went down to the White House and said, I guess I have to do one. And they said, yeah, you go ahead and do an estimate, but make sure it comes out the same way that Vice President Cheney did on the 26th of August, 2002, when he said there were weapons of mass destruction there and that Saddam Hussein was developing a nuclear weapon, which he could get much sooner than anybody might suggest. And so the first evidence might come in the way of a mushroom cloud.
Right.
So that's what happened. In other words, Tenet went back. And, you know, what I'd like to reflect on is, if that had happened in my day, and the director of Central Intelligence came back from the White House and said, now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to do this estimate, and it has to come out this way because that's the way the White House wants it, we would have laughed them to scorn.
Yeah,
we would have said, give me a break. You're kidding, right? And if he wasn't kidding, he would know damn well that he had an insurrection on his hands. And for that reason, no DCI, in my experience, would have tried that kind of thing.
So I do
That's
want to
not
pick,
what we do.
I do want to pick up on that because I'm curious as to how it was possible to force that onto the CIA. But before we go to that topic, we have a couple of callers on the line. I wondered if you'd be willing to take their calls.
I'd be delighted.
Okay, thank you. First caller, please.
Hello?
Yes, hi. You're talking with Ray McGovern on Left Out. If you have a question, would you go ahead, please?
I would like to ask Mr. McGovern. I remember distinctly back in the 91 to 1996 period when Mr. Rolf Achaeus was the head weapons inspector of the UN. I distinctly remember reading in the alternative press his findings that indeed all of the programs were dismantled, and in his estimates, they wouldn't be able to be reconstituted because of the sanctions strangulation. Of course, we know that he was replaced by Mr. Butler because the Clinton administration did not want to hear that there was compliance. But outside of Mr. Ritter giving a dissenting opinion prior to invasion, why wasn't Mr. Achaeus' findings brought out even by the UN Security Council itself?
Okay. Mr. McGovern, would you care to answer that?
That's a very good question. You know, it's hard to visualize or kind of really appreciate the power that the United States exerts in international fora such as the United Nations. I think a large part of the answer to your question is timidity. People not willing to do battle with the U.S. unless it's absolutely necessary. But I think, really, your question is a very good one, and that there's another answer to it, and that is that not only did Achaeus say these things, but an unimpeachable Iraqi source namely a son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, his name was Hussein Kamel, defected to Jordan in 1995. Now, this was no ordinary son-in-law. He happened to have been the manager of their chemical, biological, nuclear, and their missile programs. They all came under his aegis. And he reported to U.S. and U.N. Interrogators that all those programs had been destroyed and dismantled in July of 1991. Now, he also told them all kinds of interesting information about where the biological and chemical weapons had been hid, and he also fingered one place where they hadn't been found yet. Everything he said checked out, but the U.S. government and the U.N. acquiesced in suppressing the rest of the story, namely that, yes, there were all these weapons, but they were all destroyed at his order. And we have confirmation of that post-war from somebody who was on the receiving end of his order. And, of course, we know now that he was telling the truth. That report was repressed. So you not only had chaos, but you had from the horse's mouth, you know, in the intelligence business would say, a source with excellent access. What could be better access than what he had? And so that was repressed. But I have to tell you also that, as a footnote to this story, 4 weeks before the war started, Newsweek got a hold of this story. It's a long story, but an enterprising journalist in Cambridge, England, went over to Vienna, where the IAEA is, and I don't know how he got it, but he got access to the debriefing report on Hussein Kamel and saw that Kamel also said that those weapons had been destroyed at his order. He publicized that, and Newsweek picked it up 4 weeks before the war. So even if Condoleezza Rice were to say, well, we forgot, you know, it happened under Clinton and we forgot, there's no excuse for this at all, because unless she's going to pretend that nobody in the White House reads Newsweek, there was no avoiding the fact that this report was publicized well in time for the president to say, well, is that true? Were they destroyed? So there's a whole bunch of reasons why the juggernaut for war was not going to be deterred by any intelligence such as this.
So the question I would I would like to ask you, Mr. McGovern, is, I mean, how is it that the CIA, I've had this picture for quite a long time of most of the, at least the career people in the CIA, if not the political appointees, as being a rather dedicated bunch who are concerned with who are really, let's say, charter members of the reality-based community. And I certainly that's the image that you have also projected in your writings and speaking about the CIA. So what I wonder is, how is it possible that such an organization was press-ganged into writing a national intelligence estimate, which has had the effect of making them be the scapegoat for the failures of our policy in Iraq?
Mm-hmm. Another good question. Well, you mentioned political appointees. We didn't used to have them. I mean, it's sort of like a disconnect when you talk about intelligence work and political appointees. Even the director, in my day, the directors were not political people. George Bush the First, who was as close as you come. Excuse me for a second. I'll turn off this humidifier.
Sure.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
George Bush the First had been head of the Republican National Committee, and yet he, in his confirmation hearing, swore on a stack of Bibles that he would not act as a political person, and I worked right under him, and he did not. He abided by that promise. So when did it start? Well, what we have is a gradual corruption of the analytic branch of the agency that started under William Casey, who was the CIA director under Ronald Reagan. Casey was an incredible spy in the Second World War. He was an incredibly crafty and knowledgeable person, but he saw a Soviet under every rock. And and so this is sort of ironic, but the first national intelligence estimate that he commissioned was one on, guess what, worldwide terrorism. Now, my colleagues came up with a very decent product, a sophisticated wrap up the fact that, you know, it varies from country to country, and it's not all that simple to diagnose, but they said what they thought, and Casey tore it up. He said, don't you know that the Soviet Union is responsible for all terrorism? Haven't you read Claire Sterling's book? Go back and do it right. And to their great credit, my friends would not go back and change their beliefs, change what they saw to be true. But Casey found five analysts that would, and he set them up in a little office on a different side of the building and told them he was sure they could do better, and guess what they concluded? They concluded that the Soviet Union was behind all this, and the Soviet Union, for example, was responsible for the assassination attempt of the Pope, even though there was no evidence to support that. And so what I'm saying here is that the people who are interested more in career advancement than in telling the truth were the kinds of people that got promoted under Casey and under his successor, one of his successors, Bobby Gates, who was his protege. And so what you have over this 23-year period is a gradual erosion in expertise and professionalism in favor of people who would smell the prevailing winds from the White House and trim their analytical sails accordingly. And now we have the culmination of that with Porter Goss, the new head of the CIA, actually writing in a memo that it is the CIA's duty to support administration policies. Now,
so this is this is seriously worrying.
It is indeed. I mean, this is it's happened before. It happened under Casey, but
it's an overt thing this time. It's an overtly dictated from the top, whereas before it was more subverting people. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was more subtle, but everyone knew what was going on.
Yeah.
Now there's not even the pretense that that there's. You know, there's nice words in that last memo from the CIA Director Goss saying we're supposed to just give them the facts, but he also says we're supposed to support the policies. And either that was an egregious mistake by those political types that he brought in with him, or it was simply a mark of arrogance that we no longer even have to dissemble about this. Your job is to support the president if he wants to make a war. You have to find a reason why you can do that.
Yeah, so I fear that the latter is actually the case, is that because the reason I say that is partly a general pessimism or skepticism about the administration in general, but if you also look at what's been going on, for example, even at the State Department, which I think has had numerous failings in the last several years, but there's been a purge, it seems, of anyone who has any dissenting views whatsoever.
You know, we wrote a memo, that is, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, wrote a same-day critique of Colin Powell's speech at the UN on February 5, 2003.
Mm.
And I remember very well the last sentence, which said that, Mr. President, we respectfully suggest that you widen your circle of advisors beyond those who are clearly just... advocating that you pursue a war against Iraq, that there are much you will regret this decision because it will have consequences far beyond what you can imagine. And I think that has borne out, unfortunately, in reality. And the reason I mention it now is that in looking at what the president's done over the last couple of weeks, he's done exactly the opposite. And they're all yes men and one yes woman. And if he's really interested in finding out what the prospects for Iraq are, where is he going to turn? The agency has been thoroughly corrupted. Does he think that Porter Goss is going to tell him something he doesn't want to hear? I think that there's an abysmal ignorance of the necessity to have somebody around who doesn't need the job, is willing to tell the president what the shape of the world really is, despite the other advice he's getting. And Bush has no one like that, and that is very, very dangerous.
Yeah,
let me just show you kind of juice an example here. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, most people know this now, we were really a hair's hear his breath really close to nuclear war. And all the Joint Chiefs of Staff were saying we ought to invade Cuba. We know now that some of those nuclear-tipped missiles were already operational. Okay?
Right.
They wanted to go in there, and only Llewellyn Thompson, who had been our ambassador to Moscow, a Soviet expert who knew the Soviets, when the president said, well, maybe you ought to do this, Llewellyn Thompson said, sir, I disagree, and this is why. And here you have courage on two counts. You have the courage that you exemplified by Llewellyn Thompson, and you have the courage exemplified by the president, with all these uniformed JCS types lurking around, is going to listen to this person who knows something about the Soviet mentality. And it was Llewellyn Thompson and John Kennedy who listened to him that prevented that war. Now, who's the Llewellyn Thompson? Where is he now? Where is she? There are no independent thinkers in the whole coterie of presidential appointees, and that is very dangerous.
Yeah, I think so. I think that it is. I think it is very, very dangerous, and I think that's one of the things that concerns me the most about the going ahead in the new Bush administration. It strikes me that my only explanation for this is that the president is in fact a very weak man, and as a result, he can only function by surrounding himself with yes men. Of course, that's my speculation on the matter, but it seems like that there's a substantial evidence for that. And because it's very hard for me to understand how someone in a leadership position could want to insulate themselves from reality and from the facts this way.
We have to keep our fingers crossed, really. I don't see any other hope that something doesn't happen. We have to hope that something doesn't happen that could trigger.
Well, because there's a policy of blindfolding that is bound to, at some point, we're bound to get hit by a bus. I mean, I don't know when that's going to happen, but if you just wander around in traffic for long enough without looking, I mean,
yeah,
something is bound to happen. Well, let me mention that we're speaking with Ray McGovern, who is a 27-year veteran of the CIA, co-founder of the Veteran Intelligence Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, written numerous articles in the public press and appeared in a number of in a movie, Uncovered Iraq, Uncovered War, Uncovered
well,
the War in
the
Iraq.
You mentioned the book again.
And there's a book called Patriotism, Democracy, and Common Sense, which has recently been published.
It looks like an excellent book with many articles by people that we admire here on Left Out.
So there's, if you wish to call, you may call us at 412-621-9728. We have a caller on the line? No. Okay. So back to you, Mr. McGovern. So it's hard for me to explain or to understand how a rational leader could knowingly adopt such a role. I mean,
I want to ask a question, Bob.
Oh, go ahead. Yes.
Okay. This is maybe it's changing the subject, but just to get an update on what's going on in Iraq right now with the Fallujah, the winding down of the Fallujah invasion or whatever you want to call it, liberation. I mean, just strikes me as insanity that what's happened is the U.S. has gone in there and just blown this place to bits. They blew up half the mosques in that city, and just the illogic and the insanity of that the U.S. would be doing this in this country. It defies me. Do you have a way of thinking about this, or do you have anything to say about this?
Well, yeah. I agree. It's a mark of insanity. More particularly, it's a mark of not having anyone around to tell the president which side is up here. The Greeks had a word for it, hubris, overweening pride, an arrogance born of being the sole remaining superpower in the world, one that can throw its weight around and doesn't have to worry about world opinion. The best book on this, by the way, is one done by Michael Scheuer. He published it under the anonymous author's name, but the name of it is Imperial Hubris, and it's well worth reading by anyone who's interested in learning about Al-Qaeda. And the subtext there, the subtitle really, is Why the West is Losing the War on Terror.
And he's recently resigned from the CIA, is that correct?
Yes, he was one of the casualties, and that is a matter of great concern because Michael was the expert on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, and yourself has noted, they've not been able to really train other people with that kind of expertise. So what these folks don't know is that this war is unwinnable. I've been saying that for over a year now, and I can only say that with this kind of confidence because I've been through the Vietnam thing, okay?
Right, so that's why we bring up Fallujah.
Yeah, and so what you've got is you've got 1.3 million Muslims in the world, okay?
And billion? 1.3 billion?
It's a billion, yeah, 1.3 million. And you have them watching TV and watching the blowing up of Fallujah, watching the Marines shoot up wounded prisoners, watching the prison abuses and all that, and you are cooking up incredible hatred for everything that America stands for. And the recruiting lines for Al-Qaeda have never been longer. That's demonstrable. And so what this president thinks he's doing, if he thinks he can prevail in a guerrilla war of this kind with 140,000 troops there, he's not getting very good advice at all. And, you know, this really goes back to the corruption of our senior military leadership as well. We saw it in Vietnam. The good military folks that spoke out, they were all dissed by McNamara and his whiz kids, who knew very little about guerrilla warfare. And what McNamara did was bring in toadies, people who would salute sharply and not have the interests of their troops or their country most at hand, but interests of their next star, so to speak. That's what we have here. Remember what happened to General Shinseki?
Yes.
Eric Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff. He was asked by Congress in February of 2003, just a month before the war, well, how many troops would you need to go in there and attack and occupy Iraq? And he said, sir, it would take several hundred thousand. Okay. Now, what happened to him? Well, a week later, Paul Wolfowitz, who knows nothing of war, said, well, that's unreasonable. That's way off the mark. We don't need that many at all. Well, who turned out to be right? Shinseki, of course.
Yes.
And so what we're going to do now, we will be building up to that magic figure of 500,000. Now, why do I say 500,000? Well, I think history is really illustrative here. Let's take Vietnam. After World War II, when the French were thinking, well, maybe we ought to win back Indochina, they sent their preeminent war hero, General Leclerc, out there to Vietnam, and he said, find out how many troops we'd need to take back Vietnam. And he reported back, and he said, sir, it would take 500,000, and even then, we couldn't do it. Fast forward 18 years. The United States of America has 535,000 troops in Vietnam, and we couldn't do it.
I see.
Now, fast forward to Shinseki. He says to take several hundred thousand. We know now he was talking about 400,000. Rumsfeld said, now we can do it with 180,000, something like that. Shinseki turns out to be right. And the very prestigious London International Institute for Strategic Studies has just come out with a report saying that in order to pacify and occupy Iraq, it will take, guess what? 500,000 troops. Now, this
so
is not.
We have a caller on. Yeah, may I interrupt briefly? Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Well, I just wanted to say this is not some left-wing think tank. This is the institute that hosted President Bush himself last November when the administration was finding it actually difficult to get a proper invitation.
So, Mr. McGovern, we have another caller. If you're willing to take a question, caller.
Sure.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just barely.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
that's
I don't
better.
Have a very good connection.
Okay.
But I'll try and speak loudly.
Okay.
It's a little bit of speculation, but I was hoping Mr. McGovern could set my fears to rest. But two recent events after the election have caused me to be fearful that our president, it may be partially that he has incredible hubris about his governing, but it also may be that he is a weak president in the fact that he's not able to really control everything. The most recent example that I'm thinking of is this intelligence bill where he expressed his desire to have the thing go through with budgetary authority reassigned to the director, and Donald Rumsfeld at the same time is expressing his desire to keep that budgetary authority at the Pentagon. And Donald Rumsfeld wins the day over the president, and with using the higher ups in the Congress. And I just wanted to ask Mr. McGovern if he thinks that some really hardball politics are going on, if somebody has something over this president that George W. Bush does not want to get publicized, or something like that. I know it's a complete conspiracy theory, but that's all. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for the
call.
Mr. McGovern, would you care to respond to that?
Sure, yeah. It's another good question. You've got a bunch of good questions tonight.
That's great.
The president doesn't want this bill. He made it clear at the outset he didn't want it, and he only says he wants it because of the anointed status of the 9/11 Commission. You know, they've all been sort of beatified already, a status which they don't deserve. But the country has been given the line that these folks have come up with wonderful recommendations, and who wants to look like they're not going to implement wonderful recommendations that might prevent another 9/11, okay? The president doesn't really need this bill, and Rumsfeld has argued, and there's a very legitimate argument here. You know, if I were the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I would not want anybody else controlling any of the assets, especially in time of war. So the bill bit the dust, or at least it looks like it's bitten the dust, and that's a good thing because it included some real dangers to our civil liberties by putting internal and external intelligence activities under one person, and it's totally unnecessary because the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, who doubles as the head of the CIA, has all the authority he needs once the president gives him that authority in an executive order. That's what happened when Jimmy Carter gave that kind of authority with an executive order for Stansfield Turner, who was our last good DCI. And actually, President Bush belatedly did sign executive orders like that to give the incumbent there in CIA the kinds of authority he needs, because the legislation says that the legislation of 1947 talks about the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, having the authority and responsibility to coordinate the activities of the intelligence agencies and the intelligence community. And all the president has to do is say, this means that he will have this kind of influence on the budgets and be able to move people from one agency to another and so forth. And that's what Jimmy Carter did, and that's what George Bush has done belatedly. So in sum, I don't see this as a big win. Well, it is a win for Don Rumsfeld, but for once I find myself half agreeing with Rumsfeld and his uniformed service people, and I don't see the president as being dragged into it by Rumsfeld. I think the president was just as happy that the thing seems to have died.
Good. So another question I wanted to ask you, we have about 5 minutes remaining in the program. Another question I wanted to ask you is about someone who you may very well know personally, I'm not sure, which is the Valerie Plame, if I'm pronouncing her name properly, Ambassador Joseph Wilson's wife, who was outed quite clearly by the White House about 1 year ago in retaliation, it appears, for Joseph Wilson speaking out against the Bush administration's policies in Iraq. And I wondered if you might comment on that. You may have some information, or you may have a perspective that many of our listeners don't read in the New York Times. From what we can tell, there's some sort of charade going on, because the last we heard before the election was a highly publicized attempt to pressure Judith Miller, of which we'll have to speak more another time. We won't have time today. She's a topic of some interest in her own right. But in any case, they were after Judith Miller, who apparently had nothing to do with outing her, and no progress has been made on this whole issue. I wondered if you could please comment on that.
Yeah. Well, what should have happened is there should have been an independent prosecutor appointed. Instead of that, they picked this fellow Fitzgerald, but made him subservient to the deputy attorney general, so he's not a free actor in any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us predicted as early as January, when he was first announced, or December, that nothing would be done until after the election. There was a lot of motion, a lot of activity, but there would be no indictments or anything like that until after the election. Now, if the election had come out otherwise, I think that Fitzgerald and the Justice Department might have had a chance to actually prosecute the offenders. But I don't see any chance of that now. The whole system has been so thoroughly politicized that if it was Karl Rove or it was somebody on the vice president's staff, there's no likelihood at all that Fitzgerald would be given the authority to go ahead and finger them. Now, the important thing to remember here is you talked about the administration retaliating against Joe Wilson by outing his wife. Now, I see it a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Wilson is, if you know Joey,
no,
he's beyond retaliation. I mean, the guy is golden. He's got all kinds of commendations from Bush 1 as an American hero. He got all the Americans and the Westerners out of Baghdad by facing down none other than Saddam Hussein back in 1990.
Right.
You know, he's quite a guy. What this was all about was intimidating the rest of the people in Washington,
right,
who know about the lies, and making sure that they know that if they come out like Joe Wilson and talk about the administration lying about this or that, they're not going to escape retaliation. And if it's not you, if you're squeaky clean, well, we'll look for your wife. One of the reporters was told that wives are fair game. And if your wife is clean, well, there's that son in high school that had that drug problem. We're going to get you. Just don't think you can reveal these lies with impunity. And so far it's worked, I regret to say, because no one who knows about the lies has felt it possible to come out and stand tall and say, here's what I know about the lies having to do with Iraq, and this is how it happened that the intelligence community prostituted itself to the administration.
So one thing that does surprise me, and I wondered if you have a thought about this, I think I tend to agree with your perspective on this, but I wonder in the last couple of years, no one seems to have come forward, at least to my knowledge, to expose some of these lies.
Well, that has to do a lot of things.
Well, Joseph Wilson was an example, but
yeah.
So I shouldn't say no one. But
but we already know that all the lies that were told. I mean,
yeah.
Don't we? Don't we already pretty much know this? And Bush still won the election. That's what astonishes me. But anyway.
The media is the problem as I see it. The sea change that's happened in my 40 years of watching things here in Washington is that we no longer have a free press. Except for you all and a few other places, where are people to go for the straight story? They come home and they watch Fox News.
Yeah, I know. That's the tragedy.
You know? And so this is not generally known, this kind of thing, and that's how they get away with it.
All righty. Well, thank you very much. We'll be wrapping up the program now. We've been talking with Ray McGovern, who is a retired veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency and a co-founder of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and he's recently written a chapter in a new book called Patriotism, Democracy, and Common Sense, which looks like a very good read, and I've got it on order myself, and I urge our listeners to have a look at it. Mr. McGovern, thank you very much for appearing on Left Out. It's been a very enjoyable hour talking with you.
It's been my pleasure, Bob and Danny.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You.
Okay, so we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with, as usual, next week will be Rust Belt Radio. We alternate on Tuesdays, and that finishes up for today. Thank you very much, and thank you to Molly Meyer for producing, and thank you to Ray McGovern for appearing on our program.